Part 4. The Social Phenomenon of Obesity. Chapter 11. Big Food, More Food, and the New Science of Diabesity. Fueling the increase in eating opportunities was the desire of big food companies to make more money. They created an entirely new category of food called snack food and promoted it relentlessly. They advertised on TV, print, radio, and internet. But there is an even more insidious form of advertising called sponsorship and research. Big Food sponsors many large nutritional organizations, and then there are the medical associations. In 1988, the American Heart Association decided that it would be a good idea to start accepting cash to put its heart check symbol on foods of otherwise dubious nutritional quality. The Center for Science in the Public Interest estimates that in 2002, the AHA received over $2 million from this program alone. Food companies paid $7,500 for 1 to 9 products, but there was a volume discount for more than 25 products. Exclusive deals were, of course, more expensive. In 2009, nutritional standouts such as Cocoa Puffs and Frosted Mini Wheats were still on the heart checklist. The 2013 Dallas Heart Walk, organized by the AHA, featured Frito-Lay as a prominent sponsor. The Heart and Stroke Foundation in Canada was no better. As noted on Dr. Yoni Friedhoff's blog, a bottle of grape juice proudly bearing the health check contained 10 teaspoons of sugar. The fact that these foods were pure sugar seemed not to bother anybody. Researchers and academic physicians, as key opinion leaders, were not to be ignored either. Many health professionals endorse the use of artificial meal replacement shakes or bars, drugs, and surgery as evidence-based diet aids. Forget about eating a whole, unrefined natural foods diet. Forget about reducing added sugars and refined starches such as white bread. Consider the ingredient list of a popular meal replacement shake. The first 5 ingredients are water, corn maltodextrin, sugar, milk protein concentrate, and canola oil. This nauseating blend of water, sugar, and canola oil does not really meet my definition of healthy. In addition, impartiality, or the lack thereof, can be a serious issue when it comes to publishing medical and health information. The financial disclosures section of some papers published in journals and on the web can run for more than half a page. Funding sources have enormous influence on study results. In a 2007 study that looked specifically at soft drinks, Dr. David Ludwig from Harvard University found that accepting funds from companies whose products are reviewed increased the likelihood of a favorable result by approximately 700%. This finding is echoed in the work of Marion Nessel, professor of nutrition and food studies at New York University. In 2001, she concluded that it is difficult to find studies that did not come to conclusions favoring the sponsor's commercial interest. The fox, it seemed, was now guarding the henhouse. Shills for big food had been allowed to infiltrate the hallowed halls of medicine. Push fructose? No problem. Push obesity drugs? No problem. Push artificial meal replacement shakes? No problem. But the obesity epidemic couldn't very well be ignored, and a culprit had to be found. Calories was the perfect scapegoat. Eat fewer calories, they said, but eat more of everything else. There is no company that sells calories, nor is there a brand called Calories. There is no food called Calories. Nameless and faceless, Calories were the ideal stooge. Calories could now take all the blame. They say candy doesn't make you fat. Calories make you fat. They say that 100 calories of cola is just as likely as 100 calories of broccoli to make you fat. They say that a calorie is a calorie. Don't you know? But show me a single person that grew fat by eating too much steamed broccoli. I know it. You know it. Furthermore, we cannot simply eat our usual diet and add some fat or protein or snacks and expect to lose weight. Against all common sense, weight loss advice usually involves eating more. Just take a look at Table 11.1. Why would anybody give such completely asinine advice? Because nobody makes any money when you eat less. If you take more supplements, the supplement companies make money. If you drink more milk, the dairy farmers make money. If you eat more breakfast, the breakfast food companies make money. The list goes on and on. One of the worst myths is that eating more frequently causes weight loss. Eat snacks to lose weight? It sounds pretty stupid. And it is. Snacking. It won't make you thin. Health professionals now heavily promote snacking, which previously had been heavily discouraged. But studies confirm that snacking means you eat more. Subjects given mandatory snacks would consume slightly fewer calories at the subsequent meal, but not enough to offset the extra calories of the snack itself. This finding held true for both fatty and sugary snacks. Increasing meal frequency does not result in weight loss. Your grandmother was right. Snacking will make you fat. Diet quality also suffers substantially because snacks tend to be very highly processed. This fact mainly benefits big food, since selling processed instead of real foods yields a much larger profit. The need for convenience and shelf life lends itself to refined carbohydrates. After all, cookies and crackers are mostly sugar and flour, and they don't spoil. Breakfast, the most important meal to skip? The majority of Americans identify breakfast as the most important meal of the day. Eating a hearty breakfast is considered a cornerstone of a healthy diet. Skipping it, we are told, will make us ravenously hungry and prone to overeat for the rest of the day. Although we think it's a universal truth, it's really only a North American custom. Many people in France, a famously skinny nation, drink coffee in the morning and skip breakfast. The French term for breakfast, petit déjeuner, little lunch, implicitly acknowledges that this meal should be kept small. The National Weight Control Registry was established in 1994 and monitors people who have maintained a weight loss of 30 pounds, 14 kilograms, for more than 1 year. The majority, 78%, of the National Weight Control Registry participants eat breakfast. This, we are told, is proof that eating breakfast aids weight loss. But what percentage of those who did not lose weight ate breakfast? Without knowing, it's impossible to draw any firm conclusions. What if 78% of those that did not lose weight also ate breakfast? This data is not available. Furthermore, the National Weight Control Registry itself is a highly self-selected population and not representative of the general population. For example, 77% of registrants are women, 82% are college-educated, and 95% are Caucasian. Furthermore, an association, for instance, between weight loss and eating breakfast, does not mean causality. A 2013 systematic review of breakfast eating found that most studies interpreted the available evidence in favor of their own bias. Authors who previously believed that breakfast protected against obesity interpreted the evidence as supportive. In fact, there are few controlled trials, and most of those show no protective effect from eating breakfast. It is simply not necessary to eat the minute we wake up. We imagine the need to fuel up for the day ahead. However, our body has already done that automatically. Every morning, just before we wake up, a natural circadian rhythm jolts our bodies with a heady mix of growth hormone, cortisol, epinephrine, and norepinephrine, adrenaline. This cocktail stimulates the liver to make new glucose, essentially giving us a shot of the good stuff to wake us up. This effect is called the dawn phenomenon, and it has been well described for decades. Many people are not hungry in the morning. The natural cortisol and adrenaline released stimulates a mild fight-or-flight response, which activates the sympathetic nervous system. Our bodies are gearing up for action in the morning, not for eating. All these hormones release glucose into the blood for quick energy. We're already gassed up and ready to go. There is simply no need to refuel with sugary cereals and bagels. Morning hunger is often a behavior learned over decades, starting in childhood. The word breakfast literally means the meal that breaks our fast, which is the period when we are sleeping and therefore not eating. If we eat our first meal at 12 noon, then grilled salmon salad will be our break fast meal, and there's nothing wrong with that. A large breakfast is thought to reduce food intake throughout the rest of the day. However, such does not always seem to be the case. Studies show that lunch and dinner portions tend to stay constant, regardless of the amount of calories taken at breakfast. The more one eats at breakfast, the higher the total caloric intake over the entire day. Worse, taking breakfast increases the number of eating opportunities in a day. Breakfast eaters, therefore, tend to eat more and eat more often, a deadly combination. Furthermore, many people confess that they are not hungry first thing in the morning and force themselves to eat only because they feel that doing so is the healthy choice. As ridiculous as it sounds, many people force themselves to eat more in an effort to lose weight. In 2014, a 16-week randomized control trial of breakfast eating found that, contrary to widely espoused views, this had no discernible effect on weight loss. We are often told that skipping breakfast will shut down our metabolism. The Bath Breakfast Project, a randomized control trial, found that, contrary to popular belief, there was no metabolic adaptation to breakfast. Total energy expenditure was the same whether one ate breakfast or not. Breakfast eaters averaged 539 extra calories per day compared to those that skipped breakfast, a finding consistent with other trials. The main problem in the morning is that we are always in a rush. Therefore, we want the convenience, affordability, and shelf life of processed foods. Sugary cereals are the kings of the breakfast table, with children as the primary target. The vast majority, 73%, of children regularly eat sugary cereals. By contrast, only 12% regularly eat eggs at breakfast. Other easy-to-prepare foods like toast, bread, sugary yogurts, danishes, pancakes, donuts, muffins, instant oatmeal, and fruit juice are also popular. Clearly, the cheap, refined carbohydrate reigns supreme here. Breakfast is the most important meal of the day for big food. Sensing the perfect opportunity to sell more highly profitable, highly processed breakfast foods, big food circled the easy money like sharks on wounded prey. "Eat breakfast," they thundered. "It's the most important meal of the day," they bellowed. Even better, here was an opportunity to educate the doctors, dietitians, and other medical professionals. Those people had a respectability big food could never achieve. So the money flowed. There are some common sense questions you can ask yourself about breakfast. Are you hungry at breakfast? If not, listen to your body and don't eat. Does breakfast make you hungry? If you eat a slice of toast and drink a glass of orange juice in the morning, are you hungry an hour later? If so, then don't eat breakfast. If you are hungry and want to eat breakfast, then do so. But avoid sugars and refined carbohydrates. Skipping breakfast does not give you the freedom to eat a Krispy Kreme donut as a mid-morning snack either. Fruits and vegetables. The facts. One of the most pervasive pieces of weight loss advice is to eat more fruits and vegetables, which are undeniably relatively healthy foods. However, if your goal is to lose weight, then it logically follows that deliberately eating more of a healthy food is not beneficial unless it replaces something else in your diet that is less healthy. However, nutritional guidelines don't state this. For example, the World Health Organization writes, "Prevention of obesity implies the need to promote the intake of fruits and vegetables." The 2010 Dietary Guidelines for Americans also stresses the importance of increasing consumption of fruits and vegetables. In fact, this recommendation has been part of dietary guidelines since its very inception. Fruits and vegetables are high in micronutrients, vitamins, water, and fiber. They may also contain antioxidants and other healthful phytochemicals. What is not explicit is that increased intake should displace less healthy foods in our diet. It's assumed that with the low energy density and high fiber of fruits and vegetables, our satiety will increase, and therefore will eat less of calorie-rich foods. If this strategy is the main mechanism of weight loss, our advice should be to replace bread with vegetables. But it is not. Our advice is simply to eat more fruits and vegetables. Can we really eat more to lose weight? In 2014, researchers gathered all available studies on increased intake of fruit and vegetable and weight loss. They could not find a single study to support this hypothesis. Combining all the studies did not show any weight loss benefit either. To put it simply, you cannot eat more to weigh less, even if the food you're eating more of is as healthy as vegetables. So, should we eat more fruits and vegetables? Yes, definitely. But only if they are replacing other unhealthier foods in your diet. Replace, not add. The new science of diabesity. The excessively high insulin resistance is the disease known as type 2 diabetes. High insulin resistance leads to elevated blood sugars, which are a symptom of this disease. In practical terms, this means that not only does insulin cause obesity, but also that insulin causes type 2 diabetes. The common root cause of both diseases is high, persistent insulin levels. Both are diseases of hyperinsulinemia, high insulin levels. Because they are so similar, both diseases are beginning to be observed as a syndrome, aptly termed diabesity. That high insulin levels cause both obesity and type 2 diabetes has profound implications. The treatment for both is to lower insulin levels, yet current treatments focus on increasing insulin levels, which is exactly wrong. Giving insulin for type 2 diabetes will worsen, not improve, the disease. But can lowering insulin levels cure type 2 diabetes? Absolutely. But the many misunderstandings about type 2 diabetes would require another book to clarify. Our own disastrous, misguided dietary changes since the 1970s have created the diabesity debacle. We have seen the enemy, and it is ourselves. Eat more carbohydrates. Eat more often. Eat breakfast. Eat more. Ironically, these dietary changes were prescribed to reduce heart disease, but instead, we've encouraged it since diabetes is one of the strongest risk factors for heart disease and stroke. We've been trying to put out a fire with gasoline.